Thanks for joining us for this Views and Brews podcast, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas. We hope you enjoy the show.
This is a really great night because I can read from one of my favorite poems to begin. It's not one of my favorite poems. It's my favorite poem, actually. And it is A Song to the Man of the People by Carlos Drummond de Andrade. And it's to Charlie Chaplin. And there's a couple stanzas that start, "I do not offer a tribute of a fan or partisan, for these are short-lived, but the simple greeting of an ordinary man living in an ordinary town. Nor can I extol the substance of this song I weave around you, like a bouquet of absurd flowers dispatched by mail to the inventor of gardens. I speak for those sullied by grief and a violent distaste for everything, who have invaded the cinema like an affliction of rats escaping life. 2 hours of anesthesia. Let's listen to some music. See images in the dark. Instead, they discovered you and were saved." I love that poem, not only because it's beautiful and I love Charlie Chaplin, but because it speaks to the power of film in shaping the American imagination at the turn of the last century. And this was an imagination that was up for grabs, as we'll see at the time. As we discuss tonight, certain stories and norms and identities and scenarios didn't quite fit into what some thought should be the American identity. So here with me to talk about censorship and its discontents, Hollywood's amazing pre-code era, the lead programmer at the Austin Film Society, Lars Nielsen. Welcome. Thank you for coming. An assistant professor in the Department of English here at UT. She's also author of a book on Charlie Chaplin and a book on Wes Anderson and has written a ton of wonderful articles on the history of film. Donna Kornhaber, welcome. Thank you for coming. So let's begin, you know, with the Austin Film Society. Why the pre-code era? What is it that speaks to you, Lars, as a programmer?
I think it's great having the experience of watching these films with new people all the time. And this isn't the first pre-code series. I did a pre-code Stanwyck series a few years ago. Pre-code series are sort of like one of the staples of repertory cinema. And there's the experience that I think we all have when we watch pre-code films for the first time of being like, wow, people talked like that then? They thought like that then? They were preoccupied with those things that I'm preoccupied with now? Then? Because there really was almost sort of like a buffer zone. There have been a few buffer zones in film. Like when we think about old movies, we think about the square old movies of post-World War II, where it's like, oh, I assume that everybody, you know, kept one foot on the ground when they went to bed, and, you know, they didn't, you know, they were very chaste, and, you know, a dress didn't go below here, and all of that. But that's a relatively new phenomenon, and there's a lot of really complicated reasons that that happened. But this pre-code period, it was wild, and it really was a wild period in American history, and the films were, the filmmakers were naive enough to think, like, hey, let's depict this. But then a really interesting sort of red state, blue state divide was in effect then too, where the red states were kind of like, okay, that's taking a little bit too far. And the movies, sort of grasping their wallet, the people who made the movies were kind of like, okay, we'll take it down a notch. Thanks for letting us know, you guys. So it really was an interesting dynamic. People have always been wild. People have always been base. But the depiction of it is the only thing that really changed. And that's sort of the fascinating story of pre-code, is like, this is pretty out there description, and then what changed is sort of the story here.
And women have always had opinions, interestingly enough, also.
Yeah. I hope so, or else it's going to be a short night.
I'll chime in.
That was, you know, some of the funnest shows that I watched are some of the pre-code films and the radio movies that I listened to, the radio dramas that I listened to that were pre-code, were very headstrong women were the lead characters. And it was really fun to watch that. Donna, tell us a little bit about, you know, what was Hollywood like during that time? What were the early days of cinema? What shaped this pre-code era?
Sure. Well, I think it's important to remember, and I don't think this is common knowledge, but this 1930 code wasn't the first iteration of a code, right? So Hollywood really was founded in opposition to censorship And in order to think about what that means, you have to go all the way back, right? So you have to go all the way back to the very first studios here in the States. And those were located on the East Coast. They were in New York and New Jersey. So you have Edison in New Jersey. You have Biograph, which is founded by some rebels from Edison, and Vitagraph, both in New York. Vitagraph was founded by some vaudevillians who wanted to use cinema in their shows. And so what happens is Edison, who's a character, if you ever look him up, in an attempt to kind of kill off some of the competition that's popping up in Chicago and around the country, forms this thing called the Patent Trust or the Edison Trust. And Edison would relentlessly sue anybody who tried to use the technology that he was developing. A bunch of the competition, exhausted from the lawsuits, joined into this Edison Patent Trust. So Edison would set up these exclusive relationships with exhibitors and would say to them, you can only play our films, right? And to ensure quality control in our films, they set up the Motion Picture Board of Censorship, right? Which would later become the National Board of Review. It was first called the National Board of Censorship. So it was this organization created by the Edison Trust, right, comprised of the people in the Edison Trust, that would say, okay, well, you're only going to play our pictures because our pictures are the most wholesome, our pictures are the most well-made, our stories are the best, right? And we can guarantee this because this organization, this sub-organization that we set up ourselves, says so, right? So this is how it begins. And what happens is that the competitors who can't get a word in edgewise, right, because Edison is stomping out all the international competition, he's stomping out all the competition everywhere else through this trust, they go to California because it's far away from Edison, right? Hollywood doesn't just happen in California because of the weather. It happens because of Edison, because they're far away and he can't enforce the patent lawsuits as quickly as he can on the East Coast. Also, if they're caught with his technology, they can run to Mexico, which is what they would do, and their equipment couldn't be confiscated if they were over the border. So these new Hollywood studios that crop up in California say, we'll put anything on film, and we'll license it to anybody, and no one needs to approve anything, right? And that's the birth of Hollywood. It really is an opposition to the Edison National Board of Censorship, which becomes the National Board of Review. Now, Edison starts this thing because the governor of New York on Christmas Eve, 1908, I think, shuts down the movie theaters because he's decided that movies are bad for morality. And so they're not selling tickets. And so Edison starts this thing, this board of review, this board of censorship, to say, oh, you know what? The studios that take this seriously will make movies responsibly. Government, you don't need to police us. Right? We'll do it ourselves. And so Hollywood pops up in the very beginning in California directly in response to this idea of someone telling them what to make.
Yeah. And in that origin story, I think we see some trends that last through the history of censorship, which is the sort of wholesomeness, the sort of like uplifting. This is an art form that can uplift the race, you know, all of that. Plus, censorship being used as a bludgeon to get ahead, and like a commercial tool and a tool to, you know, make your competitors less active in the market.
So what films would we have seen come out of Hollywood during these early days? What were they like? How were they distributed? Who was watching them? What was the cinema experience like?
Well, I guess I'll jump in. Something to think about, I think, is that, you know, to my mind, all film before 1934 is pre-code. And I know that we call code or pre-code this window, right, between 1930 and 1934. But you had, you know, kind of salacious, you know, scandalous content happening from the very beginning. One of the clips, we can watch a little bit of it. This is the Hypocrites one. And this is Lois Weber's film. She's a female director from 1916. You'll see there's nudity in this in 1916. And this is a priest walking through the woods looking for truth.
That happened a lot in those days.
The priest or the truth?
A little of both.
Truth is a naked lady, apparently. There she is. Not a stitch. Priest is going to come out in a sec, I think. There he is.
over there.
All right, you can stop the clip now. Thanks. This goes on for a while. There's another clip that I wanted to show. This is from Chaplin's A Woman of Paris. This was Chaplin's attempt to be to not be the tramp in a film, right? To kind of make a sophisticated comedy. It's 1923, I think, right? This is the party scene. Old-timey party trick. I think that's it. Here we go. Right. It still plays really well. So my point in bringing those two clips is to illustrate that this is nothing new, right? This kind of content had been happening right along. And I think something that's special about those pre-code years, you know, 30 to 34, roughly, is that they coincide, it's a small window, but it coincides with another window, which is roughly 29 to 33, which is where the technology of sound is being worked out, right? So when you start to think about that pre-code moment, I don't think you can think about it in a vacuum. You have to think about it as happening in the context of this other thing, right, which is the coming of sound. And with the coming of sound, with the ability of these actors to talk, you lose something. Something is lost. So if you wouldn't mind playing the next clip, this is from Wings. This is a William Wellman movie from 1927. Look at this shot. Those are two women, by the way, at that table. Would you mind going back to the beginning of that? I just want to see it one more time. Here we go. This is an extraordinary camera move for 1927. and it's emblematic of silent film artistry at its highest point, I think. I'll let you see the bubbles. There's going to be animation in a minute. You can stop the clip now. Thanks. Yeah. So this takes the first Oscar, this film. It ties for the first Oscar Academy Award. And it represents the freedom of the camera, right? The cinematographic freedom that silent film was able to achieve, right? At the very kind of end of that moment. And that freedom doesn't last once sound comes in. It's essentially gone for a little while, right? So here's another clip. This is by Wellman. This is Night Nurse. It's the next one up there. And this is after the coming of sound, right?
Come right of you two.
Notice the way the camera moves here.
Get busy.
I tell you, I can't without the proper authority.
I give you the authority.
For you.
He wants her to pump her stomach.
The chauffeur.
Oh. Operator. Operator.
You can stop the clip now, please.
Operator.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Right. So,
they're different, right? But there's a huge discrepancy in the way that the camera is able to activate, right, in that moment. And that's because the camera's literally, it's in a box. And I'm not trying to be cute. This isn't a metaphor. Like, it's literally in a box. Like, there's a picture up there. I think it's all the way to the right, I think. It's the tab. Up top. Yeah, right there. Yeah, there you go. that's the camera in a soundproof box, and it you couldn't move it anymore, right? So the kind of acrobatic Cirque du Soleil camera that you get in something like Wings is gone for a little while, for about 4 or 5 years, maybe 6 years, while the technology is figured out, right, to be able to get that camera moving again. And it takes a little while, and it never quite moves in the way that it used to, because of kind of, I think, because of classical stylistics and all of that, which is a little bit of a different discussion. What I'm trying to say is that when the visuals become less pyrotechnic, right, the narratives take over. You start to get these stories, right? These narratives that are crazy, that are just completely out there in a way that they never were before. Like, Wings is a very simple story. It's a love triangle and there's a war, right? But Night Nurse is not a simple story at all. The pyrotechnics start to happen narratively, in part because the camera is shut down and the cinematographic acrobatics can't happen anymore. Those years, 30 to 34, the fact that that window coincides with sound being figured out is not a coincidence, right? The fact that these stories become much more complicated intricate and campy, right, is not an accident. You get the fireworks happening on the narrative level because the most Wellman can do is have a little zoom at that moment. He can't be Wellman anymore.
Right. And it wasn't just a matter of the cameras, of course, being in the boxes. It was a matter of the microphones having to be. I mean, the microphones were not as compact as these microphones, and these are big, bulky microphones. And so you'd have everybody has to be gathered around the flower pot as they have the conversation.
You have Greta Garbo talking into light fixtures a lot.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. So that happened a lot. The movie we showed this past week is the Marx Brothers' Coconuts, and that's their first film, and it's very much an early talkie, and it was made at Astoria Studios, and it is such an exercise in the difficulty of transition between the silent film and the sound era, to the point where sometimes you can't hear what they're saying because the music's playing. And why is that? It's because there wasn't like a sound mixer going, okay, music up. It was just like, the actors are here, there's an orchestra right there, right off camera. And the orchestra is playing the music cues while the two lovebirds have their scene together, and you can't understand what the hell they're saying. Because you can hear the orchestra.
So, you know, these stories that we're developing, you know, what are some of the storylines? What types of stories were we seeing? What was being said, and then what was being, you know, still concealed, even in this pre-code era?
Well, a big thing that's happening, of course, is you're having adaptations of stage works. You're having people who had been popular speaking stars, people whose job was to speak on the stage, be they vaudevillians or others, coming to Hollywood and playing roles. And so, like, if you brought, say, Ronald Colman or whoever to Hollywood, you were probably doing adaptations of European works that at that point were pretty risque. And if you were bringing people from the New York stage, you're probably bringing like Humphrey Bogart, Stanwyck, Marx Brothers, and others who were doing sort of urban, sort of risky stuff that was really packing them in the big cities. So that was a big change as well, is the fact that you were having this sort of sophistication. As the medium became less sophisticated, the sort of material became a little bit more risque and adult and sophisticated.
And you had talked a little bit earlier before about just what was going on in the film world at the time. Who was hanging out with whom, and how? What kind of conversations were they having during this time?
People who were making films?
Yeah, so you mentioned like in the literary world, there was a lot of crossover with the film world, and actors were, you know, like gallivanting with all of these different filmmakers, similarly to the way it is now. But you know what, as you answer that, also, you mentioned this was the first Oscar, you know, that was won.
Wings, yeah.
Wings. What was this development of celebrity? Like, how did celebrity develop? What was the role in developing these celebrities, and how were they portraying themselves?
Well, I mean, celebrities at first, it's hard to imagine, but in the early years of the cinema, the idea that there might be movie stars wasn't really even taken into account unless there was like Sarah Bernhardt or somebody would do a film. The fact that the movies might generate their own star system wasn't really accounted for, so you had the phenomenon of the Biograph Girl, which was Biograph made these films, and the actress who was in the Biograph films was not credited. She was just, people would show up and they said, we want to see that girl again, the Biograph Girl. And there were a couple of different Biograph Girls, but eventually, was Mary Pickford one of the Biograph Girls? No. I can't remember the name of the first Biograph Girl. Okay, if we don't know, then it doesn't matter.
I know a lot, but I don't know them. Yeah.
but so there weren't even names for stars at the beginning. It was just like, give me some more movies with that pigtailed gal. It was kind of like, that's what would happen. And so eventually, it did take a while for the star system to kind of happen, and it would be, sometimes it would be like Maxine's Bathing Beauties and Mabel Normand, and obviously the comics, you know, Chaplin and Keaton and Arbuckle and Keaton and all those people became names. But it took a while for like actually a star system to emerge.
Yeah, I don't know if you'd be willing to Google something. If you Google Chaplin on Wall Street, you'll get a great image. You should get a great image. Chaplin on Wall Street. There you go. Yeah, if you just click on one of those, on the top left one. That was Chaplin on a visit to New York. That was one block. This thing went all the way, if you know downtown Lower Manhattan, it went all the way around Lower Manhattan, and that was just one stop. That's celebrity. You know, he moved to sound very late. He believed in silence, and for various reasons, but one of the reasons was that every country on the globe understood his films, and he wasn't one thing or another, and he could be the everyman in every place through silent film. That changed when sound came along. I love late Chaplin too. Great Dictator's a masterpiece in its way, right? But you know, this I think is emblematic of the kind of, I mean, besides Mickey Mouse, right, and then later the Beatles, right? You know, what kind of images do you see like that? You know, for whom? You know, the first real global superstar, and it was because language was unattached. So that's an interesting part of the cultivation, I think, of celebrity. And in the cinema in particular, in the very early days, in silent film, you could just put a title card in any language.
Right. But what was the relationship between the actors then and the studios? Because Chaplin tried to create his own independent studio.
Oh,
right?
He did. And he did it.
Yeah, and then so what was that relationship? The studios owned the actors, or how did that work?
Well, this is a very complicated story, and it happened in different ways for different stars. And we talk about Chaplin and Fairbanks and Pickford.
Yeah, United Artists.
Yeah, they started United Artists, which is a company that was a really important player for a long time. But a good number of stars also were just under contracts, like Betty Davis revolted against her contract at one point. Stanwyck was never under contract. They would be under a contract where they were effectively sort of like chattel of the studios, and the studios could put them in whatever movie they wanted to, and if they refused to do it, they could loan them out punitively to other studios. It wasn't actually like wasn't a great system, and part of like the way that they kept some of these onerous contracts and some of these onerous power relations under control was with some of the censorship things. So the stars, when the first coming of censorship really started to happen, when there were some scandals in Hollywood, and the rest of America was sort of outraged by some of the behavior of Hollywood stars, and it was drummed up in tabloids, and people were very concerned about it. So that was when the first morals clause became a part of what was going on, and it really was just once again yet another sort of way to sort of keep people in line, to be sort of a bludgeon on people, and also to keep people under control. It's like, yeah, we know you're gay, and we won't tell anybody, and by the way, here's your new contract. So things like that would happen.
Yeah. I didn't want to... I'm sorry. You know, it's interesting. I don't think we think about it this way, but the code was always self-created by the industry, right? This is not a government thing coming in from the outside. You know, to a certain extent, it is capitalism as morality in some sense, right? The code goes away in 68 when it's no longer profitable to be a film that's made under the code. know, Code comes out in 30 when studios are figuring out this is a middle class, upper middle class product. People will pay $2, right, to go see a movie, and the people who can't pay $2 will see it third and fourth run and pay 5 cents, right? So you're not going to lose those people. You know, and the way, I'm going to go back to my Edison Trust thing from 1908. as boring as it may be, because it's important, the way that the new Hollywood studios that crop up in California get around Edison's kind of like megalomania, right, is they buy theaters. And so, you know, you'll have the Lowe's Theater, you'll have the Fox Theater, and they make these movie palaces, right, that we're all familiar with. And so they don't need to deal with distributors and exhibitors because that Edison's blocked out from them, right, because now they own the theaters. I should mention that the Edison Trust is not broken up until about 8 years later by the Sherman antitrust law. It goes to the Supreme Court. They break it up. Later on, the Supreme Court is going to break up the studios owning the theaters, right? And they're going to call that a monopoly too. You know, it's an interesting thing to think about the ways in which. You know, the ways in which the workaround worked, right? And the ways in which this is a tool to sell tickets, because they realized, you know, even Chaplin realized in A Woman in Paris, you don't want to see the nude lady, right? Because then you're going to lose part of your audience. So he doesn't show the nude lady. You know, and when all these concerns are coming up after the crash, right, in 1930, it's like, well, how do we sell tickets? We need to show that the National Board of Review has passed this thing, right? But it's all self-created. The government has done none of this. And it goes away when it's no longer financially lucrative.
And another aspect of the code, and I agree with your premise that the code, all pre-34 films are pre-code. The Motion Picture Production Code came in 1930. I mean, there was the precursor from 20 or so. But the Motion Picture Production Code came in 1930, but it really wasn't enforced until... Will Hayes was the guy who was running it, but it wasn't actually enforced until, what was his deputy's name? The guy who came in who actually enforced it. What was his name?
Yeah, I can see his face. I can see his name,
Sorry. Beer, man.
Anyone?
Not Hayes. What was it? Okay, it doesn't matter. We'll move on.
It doesn't matter.
It wasn't enforced really until 1934. So during this whole period, that really was sort of the pre-code period. But afterwards, it's so instructive to look at a film from just post-code and just see the kinds of things that they would choose to kind of knock out of it, things that would never have made it in. I'm wondering if I might skip ahead to another clip from Wellman's Night Nurse. This is the very last clip on our list there. And the other thing that censorship coincided with, when I think it's so interesting to look at 34, is the end of Prohibition.
Yeah, absolutely.
Remember, we're looking at, don't play it quite yet here. This is during Prohibition, and the Motion Picture Production Code of 1930 prohibited showing scenes of alcohol abuse, and you'll see just how, you know, laxly that was enforced at this point, because I think you're going to notice some alcohol abuse going on in this scene. Also prohibited, the use of liquor in American life was prohibited to show. Adultery was prohibited from being shown, et cetera. So this is about a 3-minute clip here, so it's a little bit longer than some of the other clips, but look at this, and I think that this is made during the heart of the initial code, 1930. And you'll see why we call this pre-code when you see this clip.
I want to speak to you.
Yeah? We'll go back to the bar and give Tishy a little drink.
Nanny is very ill. You must come up to the nursery with me.
What?
Nanny is dangerously ill.
Are you crazy?
Oh, Mrs. Ritchie, I wouldn't come here if it wasn't absolutely necessary. Don't you understand? Nanny is almost dying. It's my duty to make you come.
Ridiculous. Dr. Ranger is a grand, splendid, magnificent doctor. She's a magnificent doctor. Says she's almost well. Don't be silly.
Dr. Ranger hasn't been near her for 2 days. She's sinking very low. You've got to come with me.
Utter confidence in Dr. Ranger. He's a magnificent doctor. A marvelous doctor. You're an alarmist. The alarmist. Fire engine, you just, I can't see the children because it makes them so nervous.
Oh, don't you understand? Nanny is dying.
Oh, go back in the bar and get Stitchy a little drink. Oh, Max! Get Stitchy a little drink!
Yes, I am. Oh, hello. I remember you.
What are you waving at? You get out of here. He's mine. You get out of here. Dr. Arrange is a stupendous doctor. And I love my big boy. Don't stand there staring at me like that. I'm a dipsomaniac, and I'm proud of it. You hear? I'm a dipsomaniac, and I like it. I like it. How do you like that?
You're a cruel and human mother.
Well, I'm a dipsomaniac.
You're a rotten parasite. That's what you are. Don't blame it on the booze. It's you. Why do poor little children have to be born to women like you?
How can I?
Why, shut up.
Max, don't let her hurt my feelings.
You're going up in that nursery with me if I have to drag you by the hair of your head.
Let's go. Max, stop her.
Here, Sybil. Just a minute, Alice. Don't you realize that you're getting pulled? All upset?
Oh, yeah?
Say, you can't...
Come on now.
Stop it! Let go of me! I say stop it! Stop!
Oh, snap out of it.
Stop!
Stay on your feet.
Let me alone.
You mother. So
there's a lot going on there. There's alcohol abuse, there's adultery, there's her, the salaciousness of the women wrestling, and then there's the you mother. Additionally, I think that we see, like, and it's, we also, this is a Warner Brothers film, so we see a sense in which, like, this is a working class heroine with, like, a broad Brooklyn accent. In the course of the film, I think it's in this one, somebody asks her, are you Irish? And she goes, half Irish. It's like, what's the other half? Irish. So, I can't remember if it's this one or another one, but there's a clear sort of understanding that, that these are sort of ethnic characters. And I think when you look at this, this is a movie that did not play, that they didn't care if it played in Wichita, Kansas. They wanted this, this movie made all its money back, and that wasn't a lot of money, I'm sure, but it made all its money back in the big cities. And that's sort of like where the divide is in a lot of these films. So when we look at this pre-code film, it's like they're transgressing all of these things, but it doesn't feel sensationalistic exactly. It feels kind of realistic in a way. And it's sort of necessary in order to tell these kind of realistic, you know, admittedly pretty sensational stories to have this kind of content. You could make a story about a couple of farmers trying to get their cotton crop in without that kind of stuff. But I don't know that you could have made a story about a nurse in an urban area without that kind of content.
Yeah. And people from in the Midwest, like, they wouldn't see these films at all because it was so difficult to transport them there and get them there and see them there, or they just, the audiences just weren't there.
Well, if you go back and read, like, trade papers at the time, from, you'll read what exhibitors are writing. It's like, don't send us any more of these Stanwyck pictures. We can't use them. You know, send us some more of these Westerns, you know, with, you know, Bill Boyd. So it's like, it really was, these movies, the Cagney movies, these were urban pictures. And they were urban pictures made for an implied ethnic audience.
Yeah. And Warner Brothers, you know, just look at their animation, right? Think about the Looney Tunes and Termite Terrace and all of that. And it's all there, what you're calling immigrant humor. Yeah, Paul Wells has a great book about that called Animation in America. Absolutely. You know, something I want to build on just for a sec is this idea, you know, you have these strong female characters in a lot of these films. And, you know, that's something that we think of, I think, with pre-code. But it does, it is a little bit deceiving because this is also the moment, right, this window, lots going on in this window. You mentioned Prohibition, right? I was talking about sound coming in and the kind of acrobatic camera moving out, at least for a little while. This is also the moment where the industry is becoming the industry, right? I mean, you're starting to get the studio system, and it's starting to become the machine that it will be to be able to churn out those films of the classical era, a golden age of Hollywood, and everything you think of when you think of that. And this is the moment where Hollywood is divesting of women. Right? There were more female screenwriters than male screenwriters in the silent period, as far as we know. Almost all the editors were female, right? The majority of silent films were written by women. This is not the case once the industry turns to sound, once the industry becomes an industry. So I do think that even though you get these, you know, amazing characters like that nurse, she's not written by a woman. Right? And the women are being drained from the industry as it becomes an industry. And I think the pre-code kind of women, female characters mask that to a certain extent, right? Because you have these amazing, complicated, crazy, campy characters who are female that you didn't have before. At the same time, the women aren't writing them anymore. You look at a film like Lois Weber's Shoes, which is written, by a woman about a woman's life, a shopkeeper who has, no shoes, and she has to get shoes, and it's about the minutiae of daily life. It's beautiful. It's profound in some ways, right? But it's not this, and it's written by a woman about women, and so it's just interesting. I feel like there is a kind of masking going on here, whether it's conscious or just a coincidence, I don't know, but you do have these amazing female characters, and there are no more women making the movies. It's interesting.
And it's also, the role of class is changing, too. So this is between two world wars and right after the Great Depression. So what role does the economy play in that and America's idea of how it's imagining itself in the world stage?
Well, certainly the Depression, this is all during the Depression. So, yeah, big events, Prohibition, Depression, oncoming of sounds. And I think that definitely you have a sense that the economic struggles that people are going through means that they need stronger meat for their entertainment dollar. And that I think that did tend to make stories to be a little bit more... You did have a sense of kind of wanting to escape, but you didn't have so much of a sense of wanting to see luxury and the sort of grand hotel model from all the studios. So like Warner Brothers was not following that same, let's watch beautiful people dine in luxury. They were showing sort of more realistic stories.
And I want to talk really quickly about MGM and their role in it, because MGM was really interesting in that they were pre-code before pre-code. Like, they were very conservative from what I understand. What was the making of MGM, and what was their role in the pre-code era?
Well, MGM was always conscious of playing to the widest possible audience. MGM, under Thalberg, had its stable of stars that were just non-parallel. There was nobody else that had stars like MGM had. They had Garbo and Crawford and eventually Gable, and it was just all the big stars were at MGM, and so they wanted to appeal to the widest possible group. So Thalberg, who was a genius producer, never put his name as a producer, was definitely in everything that he did. He was dictating every story session, and in everything that he did, he was trying to push it to the center. He was pushing it moderate, centrist. Everything he did was doing that, and it was for making the maximum dollar. I mean, they didn't need to push the envelope in the way that Warner Brothers and Columbia needed to push the envelope to get people at the cinema. He had the stars. That's all he really needed.
Yeah, I'll jump in and say that Warner Brothers was a genre studio too, right? Warner Brothers gave us the musical and the gangster film. And think of Jimmy Cagney, right? Yankee Doodle Dandy? And, that dirty rat kind of thing, right? He's doing both, sometimes in the same year. and there's not that much of a difference. Scorsese talks about this a lot, actually, when he talks about genre. There's not that much of a difference between the musical and the gangster film. In the musical, your life is on the line for the show, right? In those old musicals, right? It's, the show must go on. It's something like 42nd Street, where Busby Berkeley is choreographing suicide, right? He's choreographing people jumping out of the window. Those two genres are inextricably tied, and they're also tied to Warner Brothers, and they're also kind of the two American genres, two very American genres.
you know, that we kind of that are kind of homegrown in some sense. MGM wasn't a genre studio in that way. It was a property studio. They do adaptations, right? They it was about stars, you're absolutely right. And it was about properties, but it wasn't about genre. And Warner Brothers was all about the genre. Yeah.
And by the way, if you haven't seen any of those 30s Warner Brothers musicals like Dames or the Gold Diggers movies,
Gold Diggers,
or 42nd Street, it's really going to blow your mind when you see just how tough they are, like how tough like Ruby Keeler or Joan Blondell is in these films. They're very ethnic, and if you think musicals are kind of, you know, lame and sort of safe, it's like,
forget
watch
La La Land.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Watch these movies. They're great. Yeah.
So I want to talk exactly how did this code come into being? Like, who were the instrumental folks in drafting the code? What were their backgrounds like?
Well, initially, I think it was the studios themselves that got together, Zucker and some others.
Yeah, they did it themselves.
Yeah,
absolutely. It was self-policing, so the government wouldn't come in and do it.
Mm-hmm. And there's another factor that we haven't even talked about on this, which is like, here's a big part of self-policing if you're a film studio. Okay, imagine you make a film, you put the film out in the world, it goes out to all territories sort of sequentially, because that's how films were released then. It ends up in Boston. Well, the Boston censors have these cuts they want to make. It goes to Alabama. Well, the Alabama censors have these cuts they want to make. Additionally, yeah, exactly. Additionally, it goes to Great Britain. It goes to other English-speaking territories. And then there's changes that they want to make. Every time those changes are made, it's like it's either they have to make the cuts themselves, or it just ends up with somebody with a pair of scissors chopping their film and making it incomprehensible, and hence much less of a draw, because people, when they see the movie, they're like, oh yeah, don't bother going to see that. You can't understand what the hell's going on. This is a factor in all of that, is that they wanted to get out ahead of it, which is why they brought in Will Hayes to be like their chief, their really ineffective chief of censorship, who was from the Harding administration, that well-known, wonderful administration that was so effective, the Harding administration. He was this Republican postmaster general who
he
they
was
brought
postmaster
in.
Postmaster general, you're right.
Yeah. So they wanted to be somebody who like, no, Mr. Hayes has signed off on it. And everybody would go, oh, Mr. Hayes, he's above reproach. In the same way that like if you were looking for a figure in American Life Now, it would be like Colin Powell or somebody, just somebody who's like everybody, oh yes, we respect Mr. Powell. But in those days, that's who that was. That was the person that all this sort of, the different censorship boards would be like, well, if Mr. Hayes says it's okay, I guess she really, that girl didn't really kiss that other girl. Okay, so this is fine, you know.
Yeah. I'll jump in and say there's one more element that we haven't talked about yet, and that's the coming of classical style. I referenced that a little bit. Is there a way we can bring up that clip, Roxy Hart? This is a Wellman film. Now, we've seen two clips from Wellman. We saw Wings, right, with that fabulous truck in through the tables at the cafe. And then we saw the clip from Night Nurse, which is also Wellman. This is the same director to the left, I think. Yeah, there you go.
Hanged in this county, but not women. It was called We Demand Equal Rights for Women.
Say, that's swell.
Roxy, please, this is serious. This case isn't going to be like the others. Everybody's getting sore. The mayor, the newspapers, the preachers, the women's clubs, everybody. It never was like that before.
Yes, sweet.
Don't you understand? They're going to try to make you pay the penalty.
I never thought of anybody really worrying about me before.
If anything happened to you, Roxy, I don't know what I'd do.
All right, we can stop the clip here. All right. So I wanted to just show this as an example of how Wellman moves into classical style, right? You would never guess the person who directed that shot through the tables at the cafe directed that, or I wouldn't, right, initially. But he kind of falls in line in some sense, right? Kind of falls into codified structures of visual grammar, cinematographic grammar, meaning what happens with the camera, right? In that shot, you had them move toward the window. Could you bring that screen back up for a sec? I'm sorry. You see, they kind of move to the left and towards that space. She kind of pushes him back into that window. So you have some simultaneity happening in that frame, right? Which means you're not cutting, it's not sequence, it's simultaneity over sequence. You're getting, you know, kind of a split, you can't see it that well there, but in the moment right before, you get kind of a split screen, bifurcated screen, they're on the left, nothing on the right. So there's some grammar happening, but it's nothing like the flamboyance that you have visually going on in the silent era, right? That flamboyance isn't there anymore. And when you do get a director who's flamboyant in that way, like Orson Welles was, right, where your camera's moving through the ceiling and you're using a wide-angle lens and the walls are flying past you. He's an outcast, right? He's a bit of an outcast. And you don't get cinematography back in the way that you have it in the silent period until after 68 when the code is gone. Sex, violence, and cinematography, they go together. They go together.
That's a quote in
my new
night.
Book. They go together because it's true, right? And then in 68, of course, social norms are changing too. Right? Kind of, social codes are changing, and you're able to content changes, right? And you get Bonnie and Clyde, and all of those films that start to happen in 68. And your cinematography comes back. Your camera starts to fly around again, right? So it is interesting, how once the code comes in, right? These films, a crystallization of the code is coinciding with the crystallization of classical style, which is more nuanced. You're not supposed to notice the director as much, right, or the directorial aspect. Yeah, storytelling first. I'm going to hold your hand, right, analytical editing. I'm going to hold your hand. I'm going to tell you the story as I want you to see it. No ambiguity, right, that kind of stuff.
Which brings us to the movie we're showing this week at AFS, Shanghai Express.
Yes.
Sternberg and Dietrich and Lee Garms, the cinematographer there, it doesn't exactly harken back to the sort of flying camera classical style, but it is not to the pre-classical style, but it is not exactly the classical style in that it is sort of like a sort of European kitsch style, actually, of filmmaking, where the mise-en-scene is not classical by any means because it is something, it's fetishistic in its way in terms of the way that it photographs, particularly Dietrich, who is a really interesting figure during this period and who... Marlene Dietrich. You guys know who Marlene Dietrich was, the German to American star who was the outrage when I talk about those trade journals. When you would read those letters written by small town exhibitors, they were outraged at people like Marlene Dietrich. And Marlene Dietrich was bisexual, very frankly bisexual on screen and at times, dressing as a man, sometimes kissing a woman famously in Morocco. And so you have, or was that Blonde Venus? I can't remember. Anyway, kissing a woman on screen. But that was a really sort of interesting phase in all of this happening too, is both in the style of the film and also the kind of... sexual content of the film that you had with Dietrich and all of the Sternberg Dietrich films.
Yeah, pre-code was like 8 things at once.
Yeah,
basically.
It's funny because it makes it. I look back at the selection of film, the 5 films that I selected for the series that we're doing right now, and I was like, oh, this could have gone in so many different directions. You really could do if you were comprehensive about it and you had an unlimited budget, which I would be willing to accept if anybody wants to give us an unlimited budget. You really could do a 70 film pre-code series without really, breaking your stride.
Yeah. And, we're going to open things up for questions in just a little bit. Jack is going to come around with a microphone. I see him back there. But I have a question as we go into questions. So what, finally, was the role of American film on the international scene? From your piece, the article that you just wrote, it was the wars kind of shut down cinema in Europe in a large part. And so America was really able to develop cinema in a different way and film in a different way. So when, during the Cold War, after the Second World War and during the Cold War, what was the role of exporting these films abroad? What role did they play in this image of what America was and wanted to be?
That's a really big question. It's a question we could have talked about when we did our film noir series, because that's such an important thing that happened during the war. Is Europe basically was cut off from American films for a while. In that period, American films got pretty dark. Nobody in America ever was like, let's make a film noir. But then all these films, these sort of American crime, pulp-inflected crime films, went into Europe, and then the Europeans were like, there's a thing here, and we're going to call it film noir. And so that became that. It really did happen, like sort of being, and there's a really good documentary now called Hitler's Hollywood that's out about like the films that Hitler and Goebbels are trying to make to sort of emulate the appeal and the great international influence that American films had, but try to make their own films along those lines.
Yeah, well, Hitler wanted to open an animation studio in occupied Crimea. Hitler was obsessed with Disney. I just finished a book on animation and war. So I know this. He was obsessed with Disney, and he wanted to copy the Mickey Mouse success, right? He banned Disney everywhere, but he would have all the films in his own private residence, and he'd screen them over and over and over again. So there's that.
He was obsessed with Disney.
He was obsessed with Mickey Mouse in particular.
Just a little bit more about this.
Yeah, for his birthday, his officers would give him Mickey Mouse reels. It's true. Absolutely. The term film noir is first used, I think, in 1974. That's how late it is. And I think it's in a New Yorker piece. I could be wrong. But no one was calling these films film noir. No. They were just these kind of dark underbelly films that made it over to Europe after the fact. And the Haïd cinema people, right, the kind of cinema club people in France in particular, mm-hmm. yeah. kind of latched onto them. And they were saying, Hitchcock is not genre, Hitchcock is art, right? Mm-hmm. John Ford is not genre, Hitchcock, you know, John Ford is mm-hmm. an auteur, mm-hmm. right? This is art. And so they were some of the first champions of what Americans were calling genre pictures, you know, John Ford, Hitchcock, and say, no, this is high art, right? So that was happening. All you need to do is watch Breathless, actually. Have folks seen Breathless? Yeah, Abou Tassouf, right? With the character who's obsessed with Boogie, right? And he's always doing the lips thing and the,
Boogie.
Yeah. It's the fetish, right? Yeah. It's the fetish of the American, which is coming from those Boogie films, those noirs, which are, and it's a retroactive, it's not even a genre, it's a modality, right? It's a retroactive term. Absolutely, American film is able to kind of flourish during the war where it's gone. In Europe, Cinecittà is gone. In Italy, the studio, this Italian Hollywood, is now a bomb shelter, right? And if you see Paisa, any of the Rossellini war trilogies, you'll see the bombed out Cinecittà. Contempt, Godard's Contempt, right, is about this too, if you see it. But more importantly, I think during World War I, Europe is decimated. And, you know, they're making great gains in the world of silent film, but it's just, it's cut off because the infrastructure is just completely decimated. And so, you know, America gets to kind of jump in.
And it's impossible not to also note the sort of brain drain that happened in European cinema during that period, because so many of the great figures of the cinema from Europe came to America. And not just names that we know, but also like names that we might not know. Great cinematographers, you know, great technical people came to Hollywood, and Hollywood really assumed this preeminence in the world that wasn't necessarily a thing that was going to happen. But the war made that happen as well. And then after the war, there's a whole thing that we could do a whole entire other discussion about. Let's not even crack it open too much. But there was an incredible period during the 40s where you had strong women, not only in film, but women assuming roles in civilian life that were greater and sort of moving up while the men were away. And then in the 50s, you have this sort of brutal sort of backlash clamp down on the role of women, both in American life and particularly in films. And you see it in films a lot, where you have the like, oh, you need to stay home with the kids. You need to raise the kids. And that's a really interesting period, is the sort of regressive gender politics of the 50s.
I love that because it gets us to the 60s.
Yeah, right, right.
Which gets us to films like The Graduate.
Right, right.
Where they're both on the bus and both of them are screwed.
Right, right.
Okay, we need to do like five more shows on the film, because right. I even want to ask you about the Western and that, like, the dissemination of the Western worldwide and its role in colonialism. But we will wait for all of that, and we will take your questions tonight because we hardly have any time left, even though we could talk forever. So Jack has the microphone. Just raise your hand. I think we have... And also, as we're going, I just want to thank Amy. Thank you so much for all of your work with Eclipse tonight. I really appreciate that. Go ahead.
Hi. I was raised Catholic, and I was led to believe that the Catholic Legion of Decency was instrumental in the code. And do y'all disagree with that?
It absolutely was.
Yeah.
Okay. So it wasn't just the studios put. Policing themselves. It was coming from the Catholic Church, right?
Well, they were kind of getting ahead of the curve a little bit with the Catholic Leagues of Decency in Boston and various other territories.
Philadelphia, too, I think.
Philadelphia, yeah.
It was all over.
Yeah.
I remember when I was growing up, if you saw a certain film, it was a mortal sin. You know, even Rosemary's Baby, that was a mortal sin. But so I would think that that had a big impact on the code in the 30s.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
When it came.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's right. But it was one of several organizations. It wasn't the only one. Presbyterian, Protestant. There was kind of a conglomerate of religious organizations that were putting pressure. But you know, again, it was this kind of self-policing so that they wouldn't do it for them. Like the governor of New York in 1908, who just shut down the theaters on Christmas Eve, to make a statement. Yeah, in the end, it's about money. It's about being able to show your film and make money. Yeah.
That's such an interesting, nuanced point. It's like, they knew that they were going to censor them if they came out with a film, so they self-censored themselves and so they could still show them. So there was that relationship and that back and forth.
Yeah, and it's also, you're dealing in Hollywood with a bunch of European Jewish emigres who are pretty worried about what's going to happen. They're really realizing they're in a minority and pretty worried about what could happen if there's a backlash from other religious groups in the country.
Oh, it's fascinating. Go ahead.
I have a question. Are there any specific films that caused a huge outrage? They had to do this?
Public Enemy was a problem.
Yeah. And Scarface.
And that's Wellman with Public Enemy. Public Enemy uses sound in a really interesting way. In film studies, we call it hemorrhaging the frame. So there's a moment where we think we hear machine gun fire or Tommy gun fire, and then we cut, and it's really the garbage truck, right? So sound is, it's 31? What is it, 31? It's a very early iteration of kind of using sound narratively and with narrative purpose, and it was scary. It was scary to people. And the violence, and also kind of the psychological violence, the grapefruit scene and stuff like that, in that film, I think, and the fact that people were talking while that was happening was a big... thing. Wellman's films in general were very provocative, I think.
And it had a lot to do with just how appealing the stars were. Cagney was very appealing, very likable. And so when you had these stars like Cagney playing likable characters and people that you could emulate and you could imitate, then that was part of the problem. Is likable stars kind of on the side of bad. And Scarface was another one. It was controversial because it was so popular and it was very violent. We're used to really violent movies. I guarantee you, if you watch Howard Hawks' 1931 Scarface, you're just going to be wow, that's a lot more violent than I was going to be. Just people getting shot up. And there's also an incestuous, implied incestuous relationship that you just can't. There's no plausible other thing that's going on in those scenes. So yeah, it's pretty shocking.
And you can hear the guns.
Yeah.
You could hear, there's a lot of it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a whole lot of guns in that.
Another question?
So how explicit...
Whoa. You got to be on the recording.
Uh-huh. Sorry. How explicit is the code, or is this just Hugh saying, I'll know it when I see it?
He hasn't.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to read the whole code to you, but it's pretty explicit, and there are general principles and particular applications. So it's basically about moral standards, standards of life, law, natural or human, God's law. So a lot of it is about all of that kind of stuff. So yeah, it's very particular. And so the code itself, which I've printed out, is 12 pages or something, is that particular. But then there are also... there were thou shalt nots, which is sort of what the code is. This comes from an earlier iteration of the code, and they're the sort of be carefuls, which is the thing that everybody kind of agreed, okay, we'll be real careful when we have a priest on screen or something like that. We'll be sure that he's not, he doesn't, take a kid's popsicle
looking
away
for
from
naked
him.
Truth.
Yeah, right. So very particular. Yeah.
I'm reminded of a moment in, I think it's Hitchcock's Notorious. I don't know who's seen that film. There's a moment where they're kissing by the window in the apartment, and it's a really long kiss, and they interrupt the kiss a bunch to talk to each other. And it's really awkward, and all my students are like, what? What's going on? It's because you couldn't kiss for so many continuous seconds, right? It was so many seconds, and then you had to break it up, and so many and so they're kissing, and then they say something. They go back to kissing, and then they say something. It goes on for 15 seconds. You're like, they don't know how to kiss. Something's clearly wrong with them. But it was because of the code. And, when I think about people like Wells, who were outcasts, right, because they didn't kind of work within the rubrics of classical style come the late 30s and the 40s, you think about someone like Hitchcock and his genius, right, is that he's able to make these amazing movies happen within code. Right? They happen, and they're provocative, and they're, they're all kinds of, they're messing with you in all kinds of directions, and they're within code. So that's the part of the genius of Hitchcock and people like him.
And I think it's part of the fun that a lot of people like Hawks and others were having, and Lubitsch and others were having was to be able to kind of get this by the censors. Because if you think about the kind of person who chooses to become a censor in their lives, probably not people who can comprehend like the most, you know, these verbal concepts that are going on, or these other concepts. So some of the fun in this postcode period is seeing the things that get snuck in.
Is there anything, I mean, the early films were very racist also. Is there anything in the code about race and race relations?
I'm not sure that films today aren't as racist.
Yeah. Oh,
I mean, honestly. Yeah. The code does not talk much about race at all, if at all, other than there's generally kind of a sort of condescension about the people who do not have the advantages that we have. You know, there's sort of a condescension about like films should uplift people who are not as upstanding as we are, do not have our advantages. And I think that part of that is sort of racially coded.
Yeah, and there were studios that would make what were called race pictures, right? That would play to in race theaters. And this is before, you know, this is during segregation. So, yeah, I don't know that Hollywood was thinking along those lines quite.
And they would not have had to pass code. Mm-hmm. Like, they were indies, so. Yeah.
Another question? We have time for two more.
So you mentioned Marlene Dietrich as one of the key figures who, you know, just was herself, you know, on screen as much as she could be, regardless of code or not. Who were the sort of other outcasts who were trying to navigate the code, you know, in living their lives, you know, as honestly and as authentically as possible, either on screen or off?
That's a good question, because there were a lot of people who were hiding throughout this period, and some of it's disputed and some of it's just true. I mean, there were an awful lot of gay stars who were not outwardly presented as gay, but who I think a lot of people sort of detected as gay during that period. And certainly you had the polymorphous perversity of Garbo, you know, particularly Queen Christina, where she's depicted as dressing as a man throughout almost the whole film. And these were things that I think a lot of people got it, you know. And then for other people, it was plausibly deniable enough to be like, oh, yeah, you know, this is history. It's a real historical story.
Yeah. That's partly why I lament, you know, what my little lament how that happened earlier about how during this period, all the women were being drained out of the production process. You know, during the silent period, you had writers like Alla Nazimova, right, who was openly lesbian, and writing about her life and making films about her life. Most of those films are lost now. But, you know, she's very frank. The frankness and intelligence with which these women were addressing their sexuality and their lives in these silent films, you know, that's gone by the time it's industrialized.
So many of the things that we think of as norms were imposed by censorship or by censorship pressure. It was like there really was a period of this time where we talk about, you hear like a little bit of a gasp when you say most films were written by women, a large number of films were directed by women. It just wasn't like, nobody had stepped in and said, well, this is a man's job, clearly, at that point until it did happen. And then at that point, you know, we look back on it and we think, that's really odd. But it wasn't odd. For a long time, it wasn't odd. It didn't become odd until some people kind of got together with a vested interest and decided to make it odd.
That's true. A lot of those women were trying to make it in publishing on the East Coast, in books and magazines, and they couldn't get it in there. But, you know, Hollywood was the Wild West, and they would take anyone who had talent in the beginning. And there was some extraordinary work that came out of that. I'm working on a book on this too. It was my academy project for a fellowship I have from the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. So I'm working on this and thinking about female screenwriters in the silent era and how that worked and how, you know, you really have to kind of re-understand film if you understand that in the beginning it was made by women, about women, for women. I mean, the audiences were presumed to be women through the teens and the 20s. In the 30s, that all changes, and the presumed audience is different.
You do see an interesting thing that happens with women and with gay men a lot, is that there's a move into the sort of craft professions of film that still shows a kind of auteurism. Like, I defy you to tell me Edith Head was not an auteur in her way as a film storyteller, as a costume designer. And you like Adrian was not an auteur as a costume designer in a way. These are brilliant storytellers whose work just had to move into the craft trades of film. And that's a whole book in itself. Maybe that's partly the book that you're writing. But it is really interesting what happens, because the last sort of person who was able, the last female director was kind of able to rise through the ranks, as you would expect, I think, was Dorothy Arzt. Arzner. And Arzner came about as, she invented the boom mic, by the way, which tied in with the early days of sound. But she really rose through the ranks in the same way that a man would have risen through the ranks as a story, as a writer, story editor, et cetera, and became a director. But after that, the path was sort of convoluted, and there was a craft profession. And I'll also like put in a word for actresses as auteurs sometimes. It's certainly been said that, like, you know, Laurel and Hardy were auteurs. It doesn't matter if they signed off on directing the film. They were auteurs of the film. Stanwyck, in a big way, was an auteur of some of those films. Babyface, which you showed in the series, which is the other great film that I should have put a clip in of that. She and Daryl Zanuck dictated the story together, and so they worked out the story themselves. And in a way, if you were as good as Stanwyck, you could dictate certain elements of what you did.
Yeah, well, she was chameleonic. She could do anything.
Yeah.
That woman could do anything. Yeah.
One more question, Jack. One more question.
Do you have the anybody.
You have the mic? Do you have a question?
Barbara Stanwyck is awesome.
She is.
No denying that.
Well, let's close. You know, Babyface is like incredible, yeah. And it's incredible to watch now. You know, we talk a lot about the Me Too movement and what's going on, and I mean this what they were talking about in that film is like way, way ahead of its time.
And it's also really interesting because a lot of these pre-code films are about this sort of European contagion of ideas. And in that film, in the original version of that film, the guy who, she works in her father's saloon, her father's pimping her out, and there's a guy who comes in the saloon, and he's always talking about Nietzsche. And he's reading Nietzsche, and he's like, the will to power, you must assume control over men in your life. And it's really is for people, and that ended up having to be cut out because it's part of this sort of European intellectual immigrant contagion into urban life that people were really freaked out and worried about.
You have the version where it's put back in though, right?
Yeah. So we played the original version, but then we played the clips where it's put back in.
Oh, okay.
And in that point, like all the things that he's saying, like Nietzsche says that you must deploy the will to power. It's recut and he's dubbed in saying like, you're doing it the wrong way. You must behave around men. It's pretty fascinating.
It is. Well, it's cool, you know, just to add on to that, to see like someone like Lubitsch too, who's mm-hmm. playing with European, you know, the kind of the European tropes and all of that for laughs, right? And like playing with this idea of sophistication and sexuality and this idea, you know, that of having fun with, you know, sex on screen and kind of poking at the Americans for being so prudish about it. You know, over and over. It's fascinating how the European element kind of works its way in and out of all of
these films. The Smiling Lieutenant, which we show in 2 weeks with like Maurice Chevalier and Claudette Colbert and Miriam Hopkins, it is such a dream. If you're just like into the American Midwest, it's like, oh my God, Europe is this sexually free. I've got to go to Europe right now.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, so where the camera can't move around, you know, the story certainly can.
Yeah. That story certainly does. Yeah.
Well, we're definitely going to check out the Austin Film Society's the rest of the Pre-Code series, which runs through the end of August. Before we leave, really quick, so what can this time teach us about our approach to cinema today? You know, what lessons does it give the viewer in their relationship with film now?
I would probably say that that having something to resist always makes better art. Like the power, or like we have many things that we need to resist right now, and I think that that's generally been a good driver of good art, is resistance. And I think in the whole pre-code, in the 30 to 34 pre-code area, they're flouting the code. And I think that in a way, that's kind of part of what makes it so much fun, is the fact that there is a code, they're just breaking it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I also think it, you know, when you're watching films today, it's useful to understand that the best directors are incredibly literate, right? And what I mean by that is, like, Wes Anderson has seen every Lubitsch film, like, a million times. You know, if you want to understand, you know, Isle of Dogs even, right? Or Budapest Hotel or whatever it is that you're looking at, you know, it really does pay off to think about what the genealogy is there, right? Because Lubitsch is all over his work. I'm just using Wes Anderson as an example here, right? But Lubitsch is all over his work, and Lubitsch had his own priorities in relationship to the code, right? And how to say what he wanted to say in relationship to those limitations. And so if you really respond to something in a film, if it resonates with you, if you find yourself kind of like electrified by something that you see, there's genealogy to that, right? And you can find it. You can find it if you figure out who those directors are watching and why they're watching it. Wes Anderson's very antiquarian, right? He likes lenses from the 20s. You know, there's all of that. But there's also the idea that the films now that are, as you say, engaged in resistance or just even in conversation with the current moment in the way that these films were in 30 to 34, like The Code, don't exist in a vacuum, right? They're existing in dialogue and in a network of all of the other films that are informing them. So just to be aware of that, yeah, and to think about the ways in which, you know, the thing that you see tomorrow is actually the thing that happened in, 1931, in some way, it helps, I think.
Well, thank you guys so much. This has been so much fun. Thank you, Donna. Thank you, Lars. Thank you, everyone, for coming out this evening. And please join us again for another Views and Brews. Have a drink and have a great night. Thank you.
You've been listening to A Views and Brews, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas, for KUT Radio. You'll find a complete archive of all of our Views and Brews in the iTunes store or go to KUT.org for more information. Thanks for listening.